All right, welcome to the Deconstructionists podcast. We are your hosts. I am Adam Narlock.
And I am John Williamson. And we are here to bring you a very special episode, a little bit different than what we normally do, but a different type of show. And you're going to notice pretty quickly that throughout this episode, we're going to do it a little differently, where we're going to have music kind of interwoven throughout the episode. And so we really want to bring art in general to you guys.
Yeah.
And specifically, you know, Av and I just love music, and we feel like it has this special way of kind of transcending even language.
Yes.
So Adam, why don't you tell them a little bit about the first of what we hope to be many in regards to artists. Tell them a little bit about who we got on the show this week.
So this is kind of a big deal for me personally. I loved what you said, John. It's artists in general have an ability to get you to places before your rational brain can catch up. And this artist in particular, whose name is Derek Webb, some of you may know him, some of you may love him, some of you may hate him, and I'm guessing a ton of you just have no idea who he is, which is really exciting to me, because that means you are about to encounter absolute beauty and genius for the first time. Like the first time you saw the ocean, or like the first time you saw, a really great painting, or stumbled across a great band, or, you know. This particular artist did for me what sort of this podcast is all about. A long time ago, before I even realized it, Derek, through his songs, took me to a place in my faith that wasn't as certain, that was more about questions and less about answers, that was more about struggling and wrestling and being honest about that in community. And he's like the Christian, like, Woody Guthrie, man. I mean, and you know, he would shrink away from that terminology, I'm sure, both Christian and Woody Guthrie.
He's
a tough guy to label.
Yeah, that's very true.
He's a really, really tough guy to label, and I think that is why he's so beautiful, like why it's such genius work. But Derek was one of the founding members of this band that kind of blew up in the 90s. It was this like folk rock, incredible group that, again, you probably wouldn't even realize was a Christian band if somebody would have played it for you, because the art was just so good. But Derek just did this incredible job, even when he was in this quote-unquote Christian world, to struggle openly, to struggle honestly, to let me peer into a world of not just halos and angels' wings and golden harps and clouds and certainty and beauty and cathedrals and polish and paint and plastic, although that stuff actually does have its place. I don't want to sound like I'm poo-pooing on it. I actually really enjoy a worship experience, and all that stuff's great, but he took me to another place. And as a follower of Jesus, as a Christian, as somebody who is spiritual, he used his art in this band Cademan's Call to show me what it looks like to struggle with life's questions. He has always been somebody that I've looked to as a deconstructionist, as somebody that wrestles and struggles honestly and has humility and grace. And so, you know, eventually he left Cademan's Call. I think that his project of honesty and authenticity took him outside of that. And he started a solo project called Derek Webb. And it's just, you know, he said he never planned on making more than one record. And now he's made a few. His first record was a kind of a critique of the church and a critique of culture at the same time. It was called She Must and Shall Go Free, and it was all based on the theology of Martin Luther. And then he's done great records on, obviously, faith and spirituality. He's done great records on politics, on sexuality, on race. And most recently, he did a great record, wrote, produced, and performed the whole thing himself, called I Was Wrong, I'm Sorry, and I Love You. And it's 10 years later, look at his first record, She Must and Shall Go Free, and what he realized is, I'm a different man than I was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What would it be like if I tried to remake that record now? So do you see what I mean when I say, like, he just continues to just portray this honesty? It is his MO. He actually calls himself on his social media and everywhere else, like, a professional agitator.
Yep.
Because he knows that that's what honesty does. And so you're going to hear his music throughout this episode, and it is just a delight for me to bring you this content. Derek is brilliant. He's socially aware. He's philosophically aware, theologically aware. He's an entrepreneur. He started a company called Noise Trade, which has got an incredible story. Maybe we can touch on that a little bit in the outro because I really want to get to this interview now. But you guys are in for a real treat here. This is a guy that I don't care who you are. When you listen to this, you're going to feel like you're sitting with a human being that understands you and that can speak some wisdom and some truth into your life. And he does that not only through words and propositions like on this interview, but check out his music, all of it.
I'm so happy we got him for you.
Oh, dude, you can see that. You can see I'm glowing a little bit right now.
Yeah, this is great. This is one of the fun parts of what we do.
And you know what? I didn't fanboy out.
You didn't.
Very much.
You were very reserved.
It's been hard. I've been listening to the criticisms of people online and trying to bend just a little bit because I know that I can be so intense. But
it's always fun to be able to do an interview like that with somebody that you revere and respect. The fact that he could admit that, look, like over the course of this period of time, I have evolved. I continue to evolve.
We're trying to get as many artists as we can. Mm-hmm. We don't just want quote unquote thinkers. I hate that terminology anyway. Yeah. Like we're all thinkers, obviously. But some people do it brilliantly with art. We actually just had a post on our forum today that somebody was talking about, man, I can listen to teachings and collect knowledge and read books. But it's like, man, when I hear a great piece of poetry or see a great movie that tells a great story, it's like all of that stuff gets told to my soul in a way that rationality and propositional truth couldn't. Let's roll tape on this interview.
Let's do it. Without further ado, here's Derek Webb. Black eye from staring through a keyhole at my lover. I swear it's not for this fear.
Derek Webb, welcome to the Deconstructionists podcast.
Hey, thanks. Pleasure.
Man, it's really awesome to have you on here as somebody that's followed your music career for a really long time, even back when you were with Cademan's Call. And then I was very excited when I heard that you were going to be doing a solo project because, you know, to share a little of my embarrassing high school autobiography with you just a little bit. I always connected with your songs more than the other Cademan songs anyway. So I would make like, this is when CD burners were like, you know, like brand new, like you could burn your own CDs.
And that cost like $1,000.
Right.
Well, maybe it was later on then because we were poor and I did not have.
Yeah.
But I would always kind of like take your tracks off the Cademan's records. And I would still listen to the Cademan's records, and I loved them, but I always resonated with what you said a whole lot more. And I think you were the first artist in like a spiritual category that I had ever heard be vocal about struggle and doubt in a culture, especially in a culture of music that was built on like certainty. Now I'm putting, you know, 35-year-old words to, you know, 15-year-old perceptions, but I mean, I think that's maybe what was going on. And how did you start learning to be public, vocal, to wrestle and struggle and doubt in that really steep, thick Christian culture of like certainty?
Yeah. Wow. Well said. I mean, that's a word that I feel like I wrestle with a lot, certainty. And I mean, I think probably the advantage that we had in Cademan's was that we just started so young. So we just didn't know any better. Like it's like, so I've got a 7 and 8 year old, I've got a 7 year old daughter, an 8 year old son. And as I've watched them grow up, it's like when you see people, when you can observe people in super early stages of development and you can see before they are conscious of kind of social realities, and they don't have any real social skills.
Yeah,
and that's why people always say that like kids will just kind of say anything. You have to be really careful because you'll have a fight with your friend, and then your friend will come over and your kid will say, "My daddy doesn't like you very much right now because you were mean to him." And it's like, you know what I'm saying? It's you know, so kid, you have to be careful because kids will tell the truth, and that you have to, you know, they're dangerous in that way. And so, I think we were just really young, and I think we also were fairly unaware of kind of the rules inside of the Christian kind of cultural institution. We didn't really know a lot about that. I mean, only a few of us, I mean, granted there were like seven of us in the band, but only a few of us had really grown up listening to Christian music or knew a lot about that. And so our first couple of years, which would have been like in the early 90s, we started the band in 92. And so our first couple of years when we were making records independently and touring and doing stuff independently, we just toured colleges. We just played colleges. All of our friends were in college. We should have been in college. Like we were, I mean, I literally, you know, like we started the band the semester that would have been my freshman, semester of college. Like I, it was right out of high school for me. And I was kind of on the young side, but kind of more on the average. I mean, there were a few of the guys who were a little older and a couple people who were a little younger, but like, so we were, you know, we got gigs at colleges because all of our friends who we had just been in school with were all now spread out all over Texas, a lot of them, because that's where we were living. And so it was just easy for us to get gigs. And so we were just a college band. And we were just trying to, I mean, we were honestly, we were trying to be like the Indigo guys, you know, at that point in our, right, in our career, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what we were after. Yeah. That's what we were emulating.
Yeah.
And talk about a great model. We didn't even realize what a good model it was. Cause first of all, you know, Amy and Emily, the way that they write their songs, the way that they, it was a perfect model for us because you had, you know, Amy who has a very distinct voice as a writer, a very distinct, style as a performer, the production of her stuff. Emily's stuff is super different, but just as it's apples and oranges, you know. And so they would divide their records up kind of back and forth. It'd be like usually they'd open a record with an Amy song and then go to an Emily song, and they'd rarely put two in a row. And so we totally emulated that because I was writing kind of half the songs, and the other half of the songs were being written by this guy Aaron Tate, who was not in our band, but he was like a part of our band, but he wasn't ever in our band. He didn't perform with us or anything. He used the other half of the writing. And so Cliff Young would sing Aaron's songs. And then occasionally Danielle, who went on to be Cliff's wife, she would sing some of Aaron's songs and she would sing some of my songs, but I mostly sang my songs. And so we would split them up that way. So like we would usually start with one of Aaron's songs. He had a much more better developed pop sensibility than I did. And he was a much better writer. He's always been a much better writer than I was. And so we would start with like an Aaron song and then go to one of mine, go back to one of his. We had just super different energies. And the other thing that I think was really informative for us, and we didn't know it at the time, was, you know, here you have, at the time, there really couldn't have been a more different group of people. You've got, so the Indigo Girls, which are, you know, like are really strong women, really independent thinking, women and, you know, activists and independent record label owners and, you know, pioneers in their industry and also gay, both of them. And then you have us and we're like these white, you know, college age kind of Christian kids. Yeah. And like, they're, you know, we were a pretty different couple of groups of folks. And yet when we, and I, this is the power of great songwriting and of what music can do, what great music, what transcendent music can do, and what it's what their music still honestly does, even 20, almost 5 years later, still does to me, is you didn't have to be a 30-something lesbian woman to understand and resonate with the songs that they were writing, because the songs were just so good, and the emotion that they were able to bottle in those songs was so transcendent and true and real. And so, like, they were literally writing the emotional soundtrack from my 20s, you know, and like I related to them completely, like all the way down to the raw emotion. I really did. And, and yet we couldn't have been more different. So that was like a great, that was what we were emulating. Like, I wanted to write songs, and I know Aaron did too. And it was definitely an ethic we really believed in as a band, that like, we wanted anybody to be able to hear these songs. And if we were doing our jobs right, it wouldn't be required that somebody had the same life experience, grid of belief about the world, you know, gender, sexual preference as we did, in order to still feel as though we could, they could borrow the language that we had written in order to tell their stories. And so, and 'cause that's what the Indigo Girls were doing. And that's, and so I think that's part of, that was kind of like the boot camp, you know, for me as a writer. But I didn't even, we didn't even realize how well matched we were with our mentors at that point, our mentors being the Indigo Girls, you know, and in later years, we've all gone on to meet them and become very casual, but friends. Like, we, you know, we've met on many occasions, and they are just as kind and generous and open as you would imagine, based on the songs they've written. And that's exactly what we had kind of hoped to do, you know? And so I think that's where I learned it. I learned it because I had great teachers.
Oh, that's great.
That's, wow. The backstory on that was very satisfying for an old, an old fan like me.
What would you do if someone put a gun to your head?
So I love what you've said. I've read some of your other interviews, and for me growing up, I had no idea. I didn't have this exposure to what I would later come to realize was this kind of like Christian subgenre. The only thing that I knew was, you know, like Michael W. Smith and Steve Curtis Chapman. That was Christian music to me, right? And then it wasn't until I was about to go into college in the late 90s where I was kind of introduced to, you know, Christian metal and Christian punk rock and, you know, Christian folk and stuff. So I've always been super fascinated with that. And I love what you said in one of your interviews where you talk about in regards to secular versus sacred music and how it relates to art. So this is something that I asked Kevin Maxson when we spoke with him as well. But do you feel like if musicians as a whole were just a little more honest in their writing, would there even need to be this kind of subgenre of Christian music?
I mean, that sounds true to me. I mean, you know, I think honesty is definitely a big part of it. I think at the same time, so let me lead by saying this, and if you've heard me talk before, you've heard me say it, but for the benefit of your listeners who've maybe never heard of me before, like the word Christian, when applied to anything other than a human being, is a marketing term. And there's nothing wrong with that. Marketing terms are super helpful. They help us to navigate in culture to things we wish to consume. It's like it's a hashtag.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's all that it is, though. And so the minute that we begin attaching security and putting faith in hashtags, which is to say marketing, things that people basically rubber stamp onto products, services, institutions, in order for us to find them, the minute that we start to attach faith and safety and security onto those categories is a super dangerous thing for us to do. And, you know, there just is no such thing as Christian music, Christian art, Christian institutions, Christian education, Christian bubblegum, Christian theme parks, Christian radio stations. There just is no such thing, you know, and for so many reasons, and mainly because the thing that you presume about the word Christian when applied to a human can't be true of anything else. It can't be true of anything soulless. And like there simply is not an inherently saved, redeemed, which is to say right, true, good, and beautiful style of music that will be the only, presumably the only music that we'll be listening to in heaven.
Right.
In the same way that you can presume that Christian, I'm making air quotes, people are the only people who we will find in heaven. Does that mean that Christian radio is the only radio that we'll find in heaven? Christian art, you know, culturally sanctioned Christian art or Christian education will be the, that those only things? Like, that's not the way I understand it. Like, the way I understand it is it will be all of the best of culture from all time and all over will be brought into a new kingdom. And like, it doesn't say anything anywhere about this kind of divinely ordained rubber stamp that we have been stamping things with as they go down the assembly line into culture. This is the Christian stuff and this is the not Christian stuff. Because the other thing is it creates this presumption that we and our children can come into a Christian, again, air quotes with my fingers, Christian bookstore, and that everything here is Christian. So it's all been vetted for your spiritual nourishment and benefit.
Yes.
Right. Everything beyond the threshold of our doors is right, true, good, and beautiful. It's the same thing you hear with the marketing around Christian radio stations. It's safe for the whole family, right? And and the thing that troubles me about that is not only, not even, and not mostly that can't be true because it's just a, you know, because Christian artists, being one, I can tell you that this is a fact, and being from Nashville where all the sausage is made in terms of Christian content, that I am just as we here in Nashville who make all this Christian content, we are just as likely to lie to you as anybody else, even accidentally, to misrepresent realities, to tell you things that are not true about ourselves, about God, about reality. We're just as likely as anybody else. Someone's just rubber stamped us.
Yeah.
And so you're led to believe that we're saying things that are right, true, good, and beautiful. And that's not true. But that's not even the thing that bothers me the most. What bothers me the most is that safe for the whole family is a horrible advertisement for their presumed product, which you think is Jesus, right?
Right.
And he was not safe, certainly not for the whole family.
No.
So it's just so confusing. The whole thing, this whole Christian, and yet a lot of people, maybe you guys and I did to some extent, grow up with parents and with people in your community who are basically looking for that marketing category, that hashtag, so to speak. And huddling us around those things and basically making us fearful of everything else. Anything that doesn't have the marketing category, we're taught to fear, secular things. And all of that is really mostly ridiculous because of, I think, did David Dark say this, that it's mostly ridiculous because it somehow presumes the idea that there is even a secular molecule in the universe, which of course there's not. Right.
So, right.
Or that's the idea. So anyway, it's like, that stuff all drives me crazy. And so I've done everything I can, over the years to try to be a disruptive element. In that. And, it certainly doesn't sell you a lot of records, but, it gets me pretty decent sleep. So
yeah, that's absolutely. Awesome, man.
And to your previous point, I think if I got to heaven and all I heard was Sandy Patty, I would think I took a wrong turn. So
right, it's like who'd want to go there?
Exactly.
You know, no offense to Sandy Patty. I mean, you know, but it's like it's like there can't be inherently redeemed. I mean, the most ridiculous way you can frame it is to say unless Jesus comes, unless the Jesus version of breath mints come to earth and live the perfect redeemed life of a breath mint and then die and then sacrifice itself for all the breath mints. There can't be Christian breath mints. It just doesn't make sense.
That was you the know, best like analogy ever.
Like breath mints have no will, they have no volition, right. They can't, right? So it's ridiculous. But if that's not what we mean, like that seems to be what we mean, though. And people would say, well, that's ridiculous. I'm like, right, but why, depending on your experience, why do you feel better tuning into the Christian radio station and guilty when you don't? And like, why do you feel like, well, but if there's Christian stuff out there, wouldn't I want to consume the Christian stuff and kind of avoid the not Christian stuff? It's like, right, but there's no Christian stuff.
Right,
and there's
right.
not Christian stuff. The only choice you have is to use your powers of discernment, which is a lot more complicated,
right,
in order to find truth wherever you can. And I think it was Lewis who said, or Schaefer maybe, who said that all truth is God's truth. And it wasn't a statement about relative, subjective, objective truth. It was that true things, truth like beauty, is
yes.
only ever residual. It's only ever reflective.
Yes.
And if you hear someone say something true, even if their conclusions are not true, if there's a moment of truth in something they've said, which you see all over culture constantly, and it comes up like blips. It's not steady streams of truth, but it comes up like blips here and there. You see it in movies and culture and music and art and writing. And then its origin is God.
Yeah.
That's what I think Schaefer was trying to say. And, it's like, it's harder to have a grid through which you can look at the world in order to see that and find it wherever it can be found and fear nothing and engage with everything.
Right.
It's harder.
Man.
And it's a harder way to control and manipulate the behavior of children.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, so anyway, I think that's what we're up against.
I have needs, I cannot deny them. I was made to want these things. I will stay if you can supply them. If you can't, I'll trade my ring for a father who loves me enough to provide what he's made me to love. It's very good, you said so yourself. Then you put it so high on the shelf, but I can almost taste it.
And to that point, it seems like in creating this whole subgenre in general of Christianized, music, art, movies, whatever. It seems like we're almost building this false sense of safety for our children, our families, and it's almost
sure.
doing a disservice to those kids. I can speak from experience. I have had family members who were raised in a very Christianized bubble. And it really had kind of the opposite backfiring effect.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it always does. It always does. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Because then eventually you can't, like, because you can only control a child for so long. And then once they're on their own and they can think for themselves and they can go where they wish to go and see what they wish to see, then suddenly they begin engaging with things that are not sanctioned, so to speak,
right.
that are not on brand. And then all at once they kind of discover, wait a second, like there's a lot of people saying a lot of things that actually don't in any way conflict with the kind of the fundamental hardwiring of how I look at the world.
Absolutely.
And,
right.
and maybe even saying truer things, and are maybe able to say truer things than the people who are writing my poetry. Like
yeah.
these poets say much truer things, and these stories have real evil and real villains in them,
yes.
where the stories that are being written by my poets don't, because they can't represent real evil. Because like the most violent, you know, and evil character in the story is the guy who's like smoking and drinking.
Right.
You know, if as a fiction writer, that's as far as you can go, then you're really misrepresenting everything about reality
Yes.
You have to, and ironically, the Bible does that. I mean, there's some really heinous stuff going on. And, and it's like, you know, it's like the villains are really bad and often they're us.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the whole story is like, we're the villain in the story, you know? And it's like, and it's, we are, you know, like we're the one who kills the only one perfect, you know? And it's like, but it's like, if you can't find stories that represent reality correctly, then once you find them, you know, it really does kind of cause a total digging up of all the roots of everything from the beginning, because suddenly you have to rethink everything. Like, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
My
yeah.
whole life has been learning how to identify and look for and squint my eyes to see things that are on brand for the way I see the world. And now I've realized that I've been looking for all the wrong things. And
yes.
There's just so much I haven't heard and don't know, and that I could learn from everything and everywhere and everybody. So it's like, it's disappointing. And I think as a result, that's that emotional reaction is what causes people to like binge.
I mean, you're hitting on stuff that I struggled with, in that you almost like in some ways, I think, helped me start to realize some things at an early age on an emotional wavelength that I maybe wasn't ready for, like cerebrally. I wasn't ready for, like, intellectually yet. And I think that is so archetypal of everybody. If you grow up in any kind of a bubble and you're taught to look here, don't look there, you know, here's the approved message, here's the party line, here's the whatever. But you can hear the tunes, and you can hear, you know, the clamor outside the walls, and you know that there, that there's more. Everybody knows that there's more, and you know that there's a thick atmosphere of fear. And then when some person, and for me, Derek, it was you in some ways, like when I heard your song, The Truth, right? It was like one of my favorite songs. And it was from my standpoint as a listener, not as an artist, but from my standpoint, here is a guy that is willing to say, I was wrong about something. It's not that simple. I used to say it was simple. That's my interpretation of that song. And here I'm going, wait a second. I know that's right. I know there's something beautiful and right and true there. But I thought I was supposed to get all the right answers and find like this ultimate certainty. And so you kind of woke me up in some emotional way at that point to later on start to realize, like Lewis or Schaefer or whoever said, like there is many beautiful and true things out there.
Yeah.
But the party line, the company line, the approved message is not even just a little part of the story. It's it's an overly edited fake plastic kind of story that isn't even in the Bible that we're allegedly learning.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that you know, art is the one place still that I feel like kind of has its roots in it's the one place in culture still where these mysterious and primitive things can happen, where else but in art at this point in our, you know, unbelievable advanced technology and knowledge about everything, which, you know, like, you know, I mean, where else but in art can the interpretation of what's been said or made be as true subjectively for the person experiencing it as it is for the person who made it?
Oh my God.
It's like somebody asked me, well, like, what is that song about? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, what do you think it's about?
Right.
You know, it's like, which ironically is even, you know, that's another place where Christian art tends to, try and is fearful even of there being a subjective emotional, subjective emotional content.
We don't want to be misunderstood. Because, we don't want to be misunderstood.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, yeah, you want to, you feel like your job is to explain everything so sufficiently that there can be no room for misinterpretation of exactly what you meant. It's like, that's exactly, like, your job is the only job of an artist is to look at the world and tell people what you see and leave. And if you're doing your job right, it should really leave, you know, you construct the room, construct the house, and then leave the space for people to populate it with their own kind of emotional furniture. And that way, even as the definition and the meaning and the emotional content of that song and that piece of work changes for you, the writer, it doesn't have to corrupt and dismantle it for everybody else, you know? So, and which is one of the ways that, like, I have found that I can still sing songs 20 years later, because I realize, like, they don't mean to me what they meant when I wrote them, and they certainly, wow. And that in no way bears on what those songs mean to anybody else.
Right.
It's like, you know, in fact, if I'm honest, and as I'm getting older, I'm realizing this, that, like, I'm only ever covering another man's material.
Oh, man. Oh,
wow. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like, 'cause I write it, and all you can try to do is be in that moment, be as honest as you possibly can, capture it as honestly as you can in every detail. And then it's immediately outdated intel, you know, and by the time you record it, release it, and then you've toured and sang it a bunch of times, you're not the same man looking at the same world. So it's like, wow. I think of my friends who are right. So I think of my friends who are photographers. And if they were asked to show pictures that they had taken in the past, they could do that. They could show you that picture. But they'd probably say to you, and my friends who are photographers, I've asked them this, like, if I was there today, I don't know that I would stand in that spot. I don't know that I would have focused on that part of the landscape. I don't know that I would have framed it that way. I'm not even sure I would have taken that picture.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? But at that moment, that's what I saw, and that's what was important to me, and I snapped it. And the second I snapped it, like 5 seconds later, I wasn't the same man. And 5 seconds later, the landscape had shifted. And so it's like, all you can really ever do is cover another man's material, which is what I feel like I do and have done for 20 years. And what's good about that approach is it leaves the space for me to suddenly join with everyone else in terms of my subjective opinion on what the meaning of that song is.
You see what I mean? That's unbelievable. I do see what you mean. And honestly, I've never thought of it that way before, outside of the fact of, you know, I like write in journals or whatever. Like, I'm a journaler. It's one of the things I do.
Yeah.
You know, I've tried to write songs and they've been so crappy, except like one or two, you know, that maybe weren't bad at all.
Well, but I know how you feel.
No, you don't. But but that's sweet of you. But like, yeah, if I read back through a journal that I even wrote like last year, I'm like, who wrote this?
Right.
Like, who is that?
All you can do is capture it. All you can do is capture it faithfully in the moment. That's all you can really do. And then you have to leave it there. But again, that's the thing that's so powerful about art, regardless of who's made it. And I think that going back to the thing we were talking about, I think that, like, one of the, this is what's so powerful about art. And I think I got off on a rabbit trail there, but that was the point I was trying to make about, art being the one thing left in culture, in modern culture, that is still mysterious and subjective and it's kind of abstract in this primitive way. And, and I know that for me, artists were who really helped me find the language I needed to say these things that I intuited, early on.
Yes.
And, you know, I remember this great story, like, and I'll tell you, even though like I don't know how I feel. I have very complicated feelings about them today, and this would be the second time I've brought this band up in this one conversation. But they've been such an influence on me, so I can't really avoid it. But is U2. So U2 has always been such a great disruption to all this, because they're, you know, inarguably the biggest rock band of my generation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
And of several generations now. And yet, a band full of, mostly, it seems, men of some spiritual belief and faith, and even something that they have chosen, which they're not, it's not incumbent on them to speak about or frame things in an overtly spiritual way, even if they see things that way. They don't have to as artists, but they choose to occasionally, which is fascinating to me. Well, you don't have to. People in Christian music have to.
Yeah.
But U2 doesn't. And so it fascinates me when they choose to and how they choose to do it. But I remember this quote that I always thought was so fascinating and so good. that somebody in, it was probably like the Octoon Babies Europa kind of days, which are easily my favorite, hands down my favorite era of U2, was their super experimental phase.
Man.
You know, the Octoon Babies Europa pop phase. That was, I mean, they tend to make records in threes. I don't know if you've noticed that about them. I don't know if they've noticed that about them.
Oh,
but
yeah.
They tend to make records in threes, and those were their three experimental records. I always love any band's experimental period. I mean, you know, Magical Mystery Tour is my favorite Beatles record.
Yes.
You know, so it's like,
yes.
But I heard somebody asked Bono in an interview, something about some song that they're basically bringing into question his spiritual beliefs, his, as he would frame them, his uniquely Judeo-Christian beliefs about spirituality. They were bringing that into question in contrast to some lyrics in a particular song that they found to be very overtly sexual and sensual, and it was just too much for them. And they were like, how can you say that you have this deeply held Christian belief, and yet the content of this song is so overtly sexual, these references are so, like, in their opinion, very like lewd and kind of sexual. and Bono, as always, you know, it just came back with the most amazing answer. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm sure he said it better than this, but essentially what he said to that was, as a Christian man, what would you have me do? Leave the last word about sexuality to the pornographers?
Wow.
Whoa.
And to which I hear things like that, and I'm like, if Christian people are not allowed to make art about 100% of what they believe Jesus is Lord of, which is all things, incidentally, not just the most spiritual 2% of everything, the afterlife and transcendent moments of worship, that seems to be all that Christian art is about, but all 100% of whatever Jesus is Lord of, Christian artists can and must make art about. The Bible gives Christians the language to do that. We just fail to be brave enough to try. And what he was basically saying is, like, would you prefer that Christians are silent on these in culture on these topics,
man,
and leave the last word to pornographers to talk about sexuality, or
right,
do you want me writing songs about it too to pitch in against all that?
Wow.
And to throw that into the flowing river of culture? And I just thought that was such a great answer.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So anyway,
it's such a great answer. I was going to ask you one question, but let's stay on this kind of vein for just a minute. You know, in talking about, you know, we've got this weird divide in culture, the sacred secular, you know, divide, especially in things like writing and music and media and things of that nature. One of the things that strikes me so much about what you're saying is it's almost like this idea of the transcendent, this idea of what is true, this idea of being raw and honest seems to wipe out those divides. And I'm wondering,
right,
like, I heard this interview, Billy Corgan, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, was on like CNN a couple years ago. It was a quick little interview. I don't know if you caught it, but he was talking about how he wasn't so much ashamed of Christian artists. He was actually like, no, like, you know, who's actually missing the boat here is everybody in the mainstream that's refusing to talk about God in their music when we're all talking about it all the time otherwise.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, so God is the third rail of rock and roll. And until people actually,
yes, I did hear this,
actually, yeah, get the courage to actually, you don't have to preach, but share, you know?
Right.
Like, what's,
well, which comes back to your original point of certainty. Like, certainty is not required to have a voice in the conversation and to have a legitimate viewpoint and opinions and an emotional reaction to the idea of God. Like, it, certainty is not required, and it better not be, because anyone who claims to be certain about it is immediately disqualified from speaking about it.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
Right. I mean, like, that terrifies me. Like, so, like that, this is the thing that scares me the most about Christians is when they are certain. They are certain of it. How can you possibly be certain of something that you've never seen, a place you've never been, a person you've never physically met. I'm not saying I understand the role of faith. I get how all that works. But what I'm saying is there's a reason why it's a mystical religion. It's because it's something you just kind of can't be certain of. And if you could be certain of it, then faith would have zero role in it.
Right.
And so like to claim to have, to be justified by faith and also be certain is incongruent. And you cannot do both.
And like, how can you,
because one literally supplants the other.
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's what drives me crazy. And I think that's probably what Corgan was talking about.
Yes.
He was like, people feel like they have to be certain to speak. And if the only people who are speaking are the ones who believe they're certain, then we have 100% of the wrong people speaking to us about spirituality.
Yes, yes.
And Derek, even if we have been to a place and we have met a person and we have like had empirical experience, who's even certain of that?
Right.
Like, come on,
right.
Come on, man.
Right. So that's like, and man, that's such a good point. So it's like, you know, because everybody who I, like most of my friends, I'm going to go all the way on the limb and say that most of my friends would not claim any kind of Christian spirituality for sure. I don't know if they would claim any kind of spirituality. I think they probably have to admit that there's some kind of spiritual element to things in general, even if it's just serendipity. But like, we talk a lot about spirituality.
Absolutely.
But they don't frame it in those kind of particulars and with that kind of language. And they certainly, that's like the thing I love the most about the friends that I have is how we have these amazing conversations about spirituality, and everyone ends their statements with question marks. It's like, we're all kind of saying right at the end of every statement, because
like, I think,
you know, and yeah, I mean, you know, like I've got a really super good buddy of mine, named Ryan Alexander, who's the songwriter, primary songwriter and guitar player, lead singer for this band Civilian, and who I think is a genius. He's a genius. And he's literally the songwriter I wish to be when I grow up. And, although he's maybe half my age. And so, he and I talk about this all the time. We talk about this stuff all the time. And the thing that, and like, so Ryan and I really wanted to, we probably won't do this, but we've talked about how much we would love to start a podcast and call it, We're Probably Wrong.
That's
is going to be the name of it. You know, it's like, we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff, but we're probably wrong and we know it.
Yeah.
But we're still going to talk about it, you know? And it's like, and every conversation we have feels like that. It's like, I'm probably wrong, but this is how it feels to me, and this feels kind of true. But you know, I can't. Especially Christians, it's like if you depending on what brand of you know, what system of theology you kind of ascribe to, if you really believe that you're 100, you know, that you're completely depraved, wouldn't your emotions and reason and capacity to discern things to the point of certainty also be depraved?
Come on,
and
man.
If that's true, how could you possibly trust your certainty?
Seriously.
And if anything, would that not also be something Jesus would have to redeem and save about you that's also completely destroyed down to the studs? I mean, so your certainty should be no comfort. You know,
absolutely.
So it's like, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Super complicated.
So I think you started to touch on this a little bit, but one of the quotes that I have from an interview that you did a while back that I love, I think that just kind of taps into, you know, the fact that you are so honest about the fact that you're like, I don't have this all figured out, is the fact that,
right.
that you've mentioned that sometimes you have a hard time believing the words of your own songs. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean... But, well, and it's like the thing that, going back to what we were talking about before, with the fact that I feel like really mostly what my job is to, you know, get good at and covering another man's material. You know, like that's my job. My job is to cover another man's material. And which goes back to, who was it, Groucho Marx, who said, my life's been married to six men and they're all me, you know. And so it's like,
yeah.
I'm constantly... you know, having to figure out, and it's a tight wire sometimes to figure out how to emotionally, how for myself, like the audience probably has no problem attaching, populating a song with emotional furniture for themselves and what it means to them. But in order for me to perform it and to be honest about it and to not be off making my grocery list while I'm singing that particular song, like I have to find some emotional hook into it too. And it might have been a decade since I've had any emotional connection to a particular song, or maybe I've completely changed my mind and no longer agree with the content of that song. And so I have to figure out how to do that. And so this is kind of where I've come to. This is kind of my current place with it, in the process of how I do it, is like, I've kind of come to understand my discography, my records that I have made and the songs that I have written from which I can choose and curate an hour and a half's worth of music to play for a group of people at a concert. I kind of see it as my personal liturgy that I'm writing. And what I mean by that is any given night, I would much prefer to have anyone else's songs.
Wow.
To sing and choose from, to craft an evening. I would love to have Paul Simon's songs. I would love to have Paul McCartney's songs. I would love to have Bob Dylan's songs. I would love to have almost anybody's songs, but mine, in order to put them and weave them together to say something about where I am, you know, on that particular night. But I don't. I have my songs. I'm stuck with them. I don't have, these are the songs I have and I have to sing them. And so, and the fact that you guys might have listened to some of my songs, even in the last week or month, you do it by choice. The point is, I promise you that I have heard my songs more times than you have. And that being the case, it seems inarguable to me that my songs are clearly more for me than they are for anybody, because I'm the one who has to hear them the most, right? So what that says to me is that these songs that I'm stuck with, many of which I feel as though I'm having to cover because I don't relate to the man who wrote them,
wow,
maybe don't agree with the man who wrote them.
Wow.
What it becomes for me is like, it's like my liturgy. It's like the, because when you go to, if you go to church and if you go to a very conservative or traditional church and a liturgical church where they have the liturgy as part of the structure, then what it is you go and you say certain things every single week. And there's like a thing you go through and it's like, you say these things and you recite these creeds and then you sing these hymns and then you, repeat these bits of the Bible. And then you don't walk into church every week believing all the lines and content of the Apostles or Nicene Creed. You don't, but that's why you show up and you say it again.
Yeah.
Like the great power and use of ancient hymns and old, and creeds and things that have been poured over by, for 1,000 years, is in the way that they provide for us language with which to confess things that we wish to believe.
Man, wow.
They're not full of things that we believe. They're full of things we wish to believe. And that's why we show up every week to say them again, and to proclaim them again and to recite them again. That's why we do it. And that's why I like the liturgy. And so for me, in that same way, when I show up and have to sing songs, my songs are not full of things that I believe, not by a long shot, and maybe not for more than a decade, some of those songs, but they are full of things I wish to believe.
Wow.
And so I will show up again and again to say them and to sing them. And maybe occasionally I do find myself believing them. But that's not required to show up, which comes back to our thing about certainty is not required to speak.
Right.
It's like, cause I'm not certain. I mean, I'm not even close to certain and maybe a little less certain every day. And so I'm grateful to have my liturgy that I'm stuck with, that I have to show up and continue to sing over and over and say over and over in hopes of maybe believing. But typically, like I'll even, sometimes I'll even say that to people. I'm like, here's what's happening here. Just so you know, like this is easily, and I'm an artist. I made my living as an artist for like more than 20 years. So I'm definitely a narcissist. But that said, I'm afraid that probably why I'm here is to recite my liturgy, which is what I'm going to do for the next 90 minutes. Now, if you guys relate to or resonate with some of these songs, all I can really say is I'm sorry, because that means we probably have a lot in common. I'm sorry to hear that. But primarily, I think this is for me, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, that's kind of, yeah, so that's kind of how I've come to look at it.
Man. Oh, that's awesome.
Well, I mean, you just kind of touched on in a different way kind of what this space that you've chosen to be a part of tonight, this Deconstructionists podcast, which, by the way, we wanted to name ourselves the Deconstructionists Reconstructionists podcast.
Right.
But because it's not about tearing everything down, it's about always, sure, always transcending and moving and going back and going forward, and like,
right,
what we're against is this kind of false certainty that keeps people locked in these little claustrophobic cages, and we just want people to feel like they can express, and that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Would you mind sharing, if you feel comfortable, a little autobiographical, whatever, like, how do you relate to that idea of kind of deconstruction, reconstruction?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's a good thing you didn't name it all that, because mostly because there's no way you could say all that after two drinks. And
that's how
and if you can't say it after two drinks, then you really, like, go ahead and invest in your future and don't call it that.
Right.
But,
We decided it'd be okay to just be misunderstood. Sometimes it's actually better for marketing to be misunderstood.
Yeah.
That's true. Yep. Yeah, I found that to be true. But, I mean, I'm definitely at a point where I think that there are seasons of your life where deconstruction of spiritual belief, of family stories that are on loop in your head, of just so many things, can be like a luxury, and it can be like a thing that you can kind of,
oh, completely,
you can kind of take a vacation into, and you can do, and then you can kind of pull out of. And then there are other seasons of life where it's like that scene in the original 1970s Willy Wonka, where the room just keeps getting more narrow against the tiniest door ever.
Yeah.
And you have no choice but to find a way through it. And so, like, I feel like I've been in a pretty long season of kind of unavoidable kind of deconstruction and like, and I think it's really proven to be a really good thing. I think that the here's where I've kind of come, how I've come to terms with it is, and I think I might have even, earlier we were talking about, our buddies, over at the Sons and Doubters podcast who are friends in common of ours, but
yes.
But I think I maybe talked about this when I was talking to those guys, but it was maybe the first time I'd really said it out loud and heard myself articulate it that way, but it's proven to kind of continue to be true even a year or so later, is that I think that what, especially Christians have, but probably everybody, I've only had the experience that I've had, so I don't know how things are for other people who believe other things, but, I think that we have, hypothetical stated beliefs, and then we have actual, or what I might call practical beliefs, like what we believe in practice, if you just look at our behavior.
Totally agree, man.
And I think I think that ideally those things are integrated and those things are the same thing. And our stated and practical beliefs, our hypothetical and practical beliefs, are the same. Like our behavior and the things we state about what we believe about the world are the same thing. That's the kind of the ideal. I think that's super rare, but I think that's kind of the idea and the ideal. I think that when Christian people talk about seasons of doubt and seasons of, you know, that whole thing, I think that what they are talking about is they are giving language to a reality that's probably been there and been true for a while, and they're just starting to feel the disintegration, yeah. the disharmony. It's like when you look at sound waves, and they kind of move, they kind of gyrate back and forth, they move the same way. And then after a while, when things are in, when things are kind of cacophonous and out of harmony, the sound waves get really crazy and off from each other. And there's a point at which it gets so much so that it gets out of control. And I think that when people talk about seasons of doubt, what they're talking about is their body is like, it's like coming out of them, that how out of sync their stated belief is with their practical belief.
Man, I totally agree.
That I'm saying things about what I hypothetically believe, what I wish to believe, but what I actually believe is super different. And the only thing I can call that is like doubt. And I don't know what else I can call that. And I think that what leads to real and healthy and also unavoidable deconstruction, depending on your season of life, is when you get to the point where you realize that you can no longer go on waving the banner of stated
right.
hypothetical belief.
Right.
That you get to the point where you don't have the energy or the bandwidth anymore
right.
To declare any of that anymore. And you realize all that's true about you, and therefore all you can really talk about or say or admit or own is your practical actual belief.
That's right. Yeah.
And so there have been several times in the last couple of years where I've had to say, where my friends will say, so kind of, where are you? You know, like, where are things? And I was like, well, right now, what you're asking me right this minute, which is the moment we're in and the only moment I can answer your question, which doesn't really have any bearing on a moment 5 minutes or 5 years from now. I feel like maybe I'm a suspicious theist. Like I think I do, or maybe a suspicious deist. Like I believe that there is a spiritual, I do believe that there's like something out there, but I don't believe I can trust it. And that's my actual belief. That's the way that I'm behaving right now. Mm. Now, is that my stated hypothetical belief? No. I can tell you all about that. I've been crafting that for years. Like, right. I mean, I've got those ducks in a row. Like, I can tell you all about all the categories and schools of thought and denominational, you know, navigating. And I can tell you all about my well-crafted stated hypothetical belief. But where I am right this minute is I'm pretty uncertain. And it's like, I think there are seasons of life where you're forced through that little door
yeah.
and you don't have any option
yeah.
but to kind of scrap the hypothetical stated belief and just say, you know what? The actual practical belief is really the only real belief. And I might as well, it no longer benefits me socially or otherwise to project one and have another.
Mm.
And I'm just going to project the same. I'm going to project and have the same belief now. And that's it's a terrifying thing to do.
Are you familiar with Pete Rollins at all?
Yeah, sure.
So Rollins says, you know, in this one conference that everybody gets kind of mad at him, and he's like, they're like, so wait, do you deny the resurrection? And he goes, absolutely, I deny the resurrection. I deny the resurrection every time I let the poor stay poor. I let the marginalized stay marginalized. I let the widows, you know, stay unattended. I let people hang in prison. I let the hungry stay hungry.
Wow.
He's like, I deny the resurrection every time. He's like, but, you know, maybe on a good day, like on a really good day, when I love somebody or include somebody or, you know, reach a hand across the aisle, then I affirm the resurrection.
Yeah. Right. It's like, that's your actual practical belief. Like, look at my behavior.
Right.
And if that's my actual belief, then that's what it is. And there's nothing I can do. I can't avoid that. I got to be honest, you know, I think you have seasons of life where you have the luxury of a stated belief versus
right.
a practical belief. And then there are other seasons of life where you no longer have that luxury. And I think I've been in that particular season for a couple of years now. And
yeah.
it's actually wound up being a really liberating and good thing for me. And it's like, because for me, it's like, I would rather be honest about that and
right.
be able to be there, stand in the stream in real time and proceed than to stunt potentially years of great examination and growth and forward motion, standing behind a stated belief that is not true and has not been true for years. Like, I think that's what's dangerous.
Yep, I agree.
You know, when belief is so well crafted that it just goes unchecked and unexamined, and, you know, I mean, we even have to renew our driver's license every few years.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like it's a good practice to go and pull it all up from scratch and really look at the whole thing again. And let's really go through the whole thing and let's really make sure that's where we still are. I don't think that's a bad thing. And
we sure don't.
Even if the journey, it can be a little terrifying. It's like, it's more terrifying to be in that place and not know or deny it, to be in that place and admit it and be in it and aware of it and awake to it and proceed and grow into it is a much better thing than to actually also be there, but to deny it and to not deny yourself the opportunity to examine and grow and be in the real time moving stream of it.
Man,
you know,
that's good.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up our time with you, we just have one more question for you in regards to the one thing that we try to emphasize on our podcast, in regards to kind of going through what we would call the deconstruction type journey, is just the absolute necessity and importance of community and doing it with, you know, whether that's a group of people or one person, just having someone that you can absolutely be authentic and real with, who knows you and can maybe speak hard truths to you. And one of the interviews that I remember reading that you did, you talked about, you know, just a tough time that you're going through in your personal life and the need for safe people in your life who you can truly be honest with, as opposed to just being surrounded by yes men or yes women. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, that's a thing that I didn't see or realize the value of until, I'm going to say, too late in life.
I wish I had had it.
It's like, you know, like, I don't feel, it's just too easy to, you know, social media is a great metaphor, or euphemism really, for, the way that we can craft what we wish for people to know about ourselves and to even fool ourselves into believing that we're known as much as we're fooling our friends into believing they know us.
Man. Yeah.
And it's like, and I wouldn't advise people to have a lot of folks, or to do it the way that I've seen some do it, like in a kind of a more public cavalier way. I think that you really want to have, you know, it's really important to have, a person or two. And I would advise, if you're, and this isn't anything prejudiced or sexist or anything, but like, if you're a man, I would advise to find a few male friends, a few safe guys. And if you're a woman, find a few safe women that you can. And the thing is, like, and if you're married, fantastic. But like, even your spouse doesn't need to be, and really mustn't be alone in being the sole witness to your failure and your questions and your,
that's huge.
Yeah. Like, yeah, you really want to have, just a few safe people with whom you can, to whom you can tell everything. And what's interesting that I found is some of the most valuable characters for me, in those roles, have not been Christians. And I know that might seem provocative or something, because what I know is that these people know me and that they love me, and that at the end of the day, what's interesting is, even in seasons where I have maybe come temporarily tethered to, let's say, objective moralism, what's interesting that I have found is that what's even more compelling to me than random objective moralism is choices that are in line and line of sight to the man who I wish to be and the health in my life that I wish to have.
Yeah.
And it's funny how things that I, things you struggle with and things that you battle and wrestle with, it's like the best reason that I've had to struggle and battle and actually the places where I have found that I've managed to really make non-issues out of all those things is in sorting through them with friends who can speak to me about what kind of man I want that I would want to be. And,
yeah.
And what do you feel like? Do you feel like that behavior is healthy for you? Or do you feel like that's not healthy for you? And suddenly I'm like, well, wait a second. So, but we're not talking about what's just like objectively right and wrong. You're talking about my, like my personal health. Like I've never framed it that way.
Yeah.
But ironically, and the two things can be in line with each other. Of course they can.
Sure.
And they usually are. But as I've, it's one of those gifts that you find when you, are open to the extent that you find that you're willing to look for those people wherever they can be found. And I'll tell you that one of the best things about, one of the great things I'm grateful for about the last couple of years that have been hard years is that, when you meet people, when you typically meet people and you typically make friends with people and you don't know why, you just resonate with and connect with certain people. You don't know why. And, but they're typically people you have something in common with and people who you share a sense of humor or a common, you know, set of cultural references and whatever it is, but you typically know good things about each other and you
yeah.
share those things. And then at some point you learn hard things about each other and maybe bad things. And that challenges those friendships. Like every friendship I have in my life at this point, on the other side of really hard things, the great thing about these friendships versus the friendships I might have had before, which is not to in any way disparage those friends as so much as the nature of the basis upon which we connected initially and the way that we did it, which is the way everyone does it, is that the friends I have now, the first thing that we learned about each other were the worst things. That was kind of the point of connection, you know, because we were going through hard things and so we wanted to find people with whom we could go through hard things together.
Yeah.
And because you're kind of flailing and you're kind of grabbing on to things and you want to kind of keep your head above the water. And so like the first things we learned about each other were the worst things. And over months and even years now, as you learn other things and good things, it's kind of like surprising and delightful. Like, well, I have no idea you were so good at that. I didn't know you were a great, you know, copywriter. It's like, you don't know these, you know, the first things you learn. And those are the friendships that these are the people, you know, are not going anywhere.
Right.
Because the first thing they learn about you are the worst things. So there's no surprises in the future about that sort of thing. That's the moment that you double down on somebody when you know the worst thing. And, you know, and so it's like, that's the great benefit of the friends you make in hard times.
Oh man.
Is and so it's hard. You have to do it intentionally.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you should. But when you're not in hard times, which is when I would suggest doing it, because
right.
it's a great antidote to hard times. It's a great way to avoid them, you know. But like, you have to do it intentionally. And so what's required is, here's a person, for instance, just hypothetically, who doesn't know all the worst things about me. And there's no, I'm not in any kind of circumstance where they would know. And there's nothing really all that horrible going on that they would know about. So I have to be intentional about basically pretending as though I've just been found out and I have to tell them everything. And I need to pretend as though it's unavoidable. Otherwise I won't do it.
Wow.
And once they know all the worst things, now I have, and they stay, now I have someone who will never leave me.
Man, that's good.
And yeah. that's a totally different type of friendship. And I feel like 100% of the friends that I have now came from the crucible of those circumstances. And that's why I know I can depend on these people. And I know that they love me, and I know that, you know what I'm saying? So it's, and I think it's so important. So as you're saying, if you're going through those seasons of deconstruction, if you're forced into them, if you're choosing to do it, if you're touristing through deconstruction, whatever it is, you really, there is no version of that journey that is without companions, and the people who you have with you must, you, there must be a, it has to be a game of strip poker. Like everybody has to
absolutely,
get nude,
man.
You know, like it's all, it's all gotta come off. Like we all have to have everything on each other. We all have to have all the dirt, because deep down, I think we feel like that's the only way we can trust each other. But
that's so good,
like
man.
When you learn the worst things about each other first, those are the landmines that you unintentionally plant beneath your feet when you get to know people the conventional way, and you know all these great things about each other, all these things we have in common, and look, we've all the same friends, our kids go to the same school, and it's all so great. And then the bomb drops. It's like, the more you can keep from planting landmines under your feet by being completely upfront and honest with people,
wow,
and being intentional about doing that in times of peace, that's the best investment you can make,
dude,
into avoiding or shortening really hard times.
That is some really great
so
advice
true.
To end with here, man. We're going to wrap up. We want to be sensitive of your
time.
Yeah,
I've kept you guys so long.
No, we appreciate it.
Look,
I'm such a loud mouth.
No, you're really spitting some good truth, man, and we really appreciate it. So question number one,
sure.
Would you be willing to come back in a later season and talk to us again?
Of course.
You know, when you're not the same, when you're not the same guy that you are right now.
Yeah, yeah, we get the
new
version.
No, you'll be talking to a different guy.
Yeah.
That's right.
That'll be super cool. And then number two, so one of my favorite songs of yours that I use for the deconstruction kind of process that I'm going through is your song on I See Things Upside Down, Medication.
Whoa. Wow.
Don't lie to me. Just tell me something true, 'cause I'm only free when I look at you. You look so good in hers, and love, I come undone. But I don't want medication, just give me liberation, even if it cuts my legs right.
I mean, if you think about it, that's really, the words of that song are pretty anthemic,
sure,
to saying,
absolutely,
like,
yeah,
okay, let's strip this down and see what's real, even though it's going to hurt like hell. Right?
Right.
So
yes,
that's,
yes,
so
that's right.
I'm telling you, that's my favorite song that you've written. Now let me, now let me embarrass you and ask you, what's your favorite song you've written?
I mean, it's like, I wouldn't be playing into the artist, you know, kind of personality if I admitted to liking any of my songs.
That's true. That's why,
know,
I said,
like,
it was going to be embarrassing.
Like,
man,
that's kind of, well, but that's kind of the thing, is like, you write them and you think they're good for a minute, and then you basically continue making records in order to, as your apologies for all the previous songs you've ever written, you know?
Right.
And that's the only thing that compels you to keep doing it, is because you feel like you're failing so miserably and spectacularly at it all the way through. But like what I'll say is, like, I think that, and I don't know how satisfying this answer will be, but like, I think that there was a record that I did a few years ago now that was called Control, and it was easily my least successful record ever. And it was like, I mean, because this, you know, it was a record, it was basically a, it was like an electronic, like an electro pop rock opera of the singularity. I mean, it was like, there is no audience. There is no audience for this record. Like there, you know, like, it was so heavy conceptual that it was like all house and no door on this thing.
Dude, it was sweet.
And, but the thing is, like, I put 2 years into conceptualizing it, writing it. I wrote a fictional short story that the record was based on, and the whole record was written from the perspective of this character. And it was this, it was basically kind of a mashup of the stories behind movies like Her or Ex Machina.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like 2 or 3 years before those movies.
Right.
And so,
right.
And so when I saw those movies come out, I was like, man, I made that record. Like I wrote that as a record like 3 years ago and it hit the market like a rock, you know, like,
yeah, man.
And now Spike, you know, Jones is doing it. But anyway, so, I don't think I'll ever do better than that record. I don't think I'll ever write a better front to back. I don't think I'll ever do better. And I've put a record out since, and I'll, you know, and I'm my goal is to put one out this year. But I don't think I'll ever, I just think that was for me. And I think there's no irony, lost on the fact that it was easily my least successful record. And I think in my, you know, very subjective view of what I've made, I don't think I'll do better. I don't think I'll do better than that record. But
that record is incredible.
That's the one Adam introduced me to your music. And
whoa, that's crazy.
And we were in the car and he popped that thing on and I was like, whoa, what is this? So
it's a super strange record.
And it was so,
I think that was a record where I really did feel, at my maximum artistic liberty. Like I really felt like I could do whatever I wanted. And I literally accepted no pre-filters or expectations internally, externally. I just was like, what do I want to do? And that's what I wanted to do. And I did exactly that. And,
oh, man.
And it was just such a spectacular failure, commercially, but like literally to the point where like I was 2 weeks into the tour, touring the record, performing it almost like dinner theater, like where I played like an acoustic set to open because I wanted to satisfy the people who just had to hear Wedding Dress. And then I basically played the entire Control record straight through with a band and in between songs would read excerpts from the short story I'd written in order to keep people into the story and understanding what was happening.
That's awesome.
And it was so strange. It made no sense. Like, it was so odd, the experience for everybody. And like maybe 2 or 3 weeks into the tour when like, people just weren't coming because people were not interested in the record. They didn't buy it. They were not coming to the shows. It was just like, wow. So I'm not going to get a year's worth of touring out of this. I literally have to abandon it and keep and go on if I'm going to survive. And I'm tenacious. So I immediately started writing a new record, came home, made a new record and just left it.
Wow.
That's all I could do.
I'm so glad you wrote it. You know, even if it's something it didn't get listened to as much, you know, I always think like C.S. Lewis has always been my favorite author and two of his favorite things, the two best things he said he ever wrote are like one of his least read books ever. It's this myth that he retold called Till We Have Faces.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, nobody reads that book.
No, you're right. Yeah,
and then Perilandra in his space trilogy, and
yeah,
people are like, "Wait,
the sci-fi stuff."
He wrote sci-fi, and it's like, "Yeah,
yeah,
yeah," and it's incredible. Like,
it's so good.
So,
yeah.
So dude, don't worry. It'll find its time. Well, the thing is,
and, you know, and that's, well, and that's not why you make it,
nope.
You know, and,
nope,
and I've had the great luxury of always feeling like I was doing what I was compelled to do and managed to find some commercial success at it. So I know that's been a luxury for me. And this was the one, I'm such a baby. Like, this was the one moment where me doing whatever I wanted to do didn't happen to be what everybody wanted at the time.
Matter.
It's like, you know, it, yeah, it's not why you do it.
Nope.
And it's not why I've ever done it.
Doesn't matter.
And I've had a luxurious career that what I've made happened to be something people cared about. But
yeah,
that record definitely is special to me.
Well, keep
so,
us posted
anyway.
On your new material. We will do our best to get the word yeah. out on that. Even have you
man, thanks.
On the show to do a little blurb or, you know, whatever. But
sure.
It has just been an absolute joy and a pleasure and just a really deep, rich experience to talk to you. We hope that we introduce
yeah, you too.
As many people as possible to your great catalog and just your journey and how you open yourself up. And just thank you so much, Derek.
Yeah.
Yeah,
really,
it's a pleasure.
It.
Yeah, let's talk again. Absolutely.
Let's definitely yeah. talk again.
And I guarantee you a few more people will be spinning control after we drop this episode. So
absolutely.
Well, if a few more people buy it, then it will double its sales. That would be amazing.
I think we could put,
that'd be amazing.
I put money on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, blessings to you and everything that you're doing, man, and everything that you are and you're becoming. And we hope we can all be friends and keep talking.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Same. Yeah, same.
Awesome, Derek.
Have a great night, man.
Hey. Yeah, you too.
In the days before the night, before the day, in the songs before the words that you could say, I have loved you. In the depths below the oceans in the dark, from the garden to the entropy of stars, I have loved you. Oh, I loved you.
Wow, guys. A little different than normal.
John, you're going to have to handle this outro.
I think I really enjoyed that interview for a couple of reasons. Number one, because it's funny, you interview an artist or somebody whose main day job isn't writing these heavy theological books.
Yeah.
And so you think, oh, all right, you know, we're going to get a slightly kind of easier, you know, not easier is a horrible way to put it, but, you know, My brain isn't going to hurt nearly as much after this one. You know, we're just going to have a fun interview where we talk about awesome music. And then Derek Webb just drops just nuggets on you.
Dude, your mouth was hanging open so many times. You weren't expecting that.
No, I mean, his ability to articulate these crazy concepts, the way he looks at his own music, especially the further, the more distance he gets from the creation of the music.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he talked about touring and how he feels like it's almost like playing another man's cover songs because he's so separated from the man he was when he wrote that music, just blew my mind.
That's the kind of honesty.
Yeah.
That is shocking because two things happen when you hear somebody say something like that. You go, I know that's true.
Yeah.
Of myself.
Yeah.
And why the hell have I never realized that?
It was such a poignant moment because I think if you're not looking back and saying, I'm not that person anymore, then you have not evolved or changed as a person or grown up in any form or sense. So I think,
dude,
that was such a huge, heavy hitting moment for me. I'm like, oh, yeah.
And the fact that the term liturgy that he used and the way that he used it, that his songs are his own liturgy.
Yeah.
That, like, dude, they were his songs, and he's like, you know, I own these, and these are mine, but at the same time, like, I'm not that guy, and I'm almost trying to become that guy, or I want to be that guy, and
right.
It's like, I didn't get Bob Dylan's songs. I got my songs.
Right.
And they're part of my story, even if I have tension and frustration and disbelief and doubt and distance from these things. That's the kind of honesty that we want to foster through this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, oh gosh. Like it's going to take me a while to process some of the things that he said. I just, and And I have a bet going with him now. So I'm going to need at least two of you to go out and buy the album Control.
Yeah.
Just so I can be right.
And then tweet it out.
Yeah.
Or share it on Instagram
him, yeah.
or Facebook.
Yeah.
Because
it's such a beautiful album.
Oh my gosh.
Why do more people not have this? I don't understand.
First of all, it's a concept album about like artificial intelligence and souls and spirit. What an incredible album. And the composition, I was astounded by it. I was like, yeah. I don't even know what to do with this. So yeah, Control. But all of his albums and all of his collaborations. And by the way, if you haven't, John, do you like free music?
Oh, I love free music.
Do you love free music?
I love free music.
Did you know that noisetrade.com has thousands and thousands and thousands of phenomenal artists that you can download for free?
Oh, yeah. And if you fancy yourself kind of hipster, then there is nothing more underground than some of the artists that they have featured on this website.
Did you know I discovered, I'm the one that discovered the Civil Wars.
I did. I had heard that
rumor. Did you know that? Have you heard this? It's circulating on the internet.
I'm going to need you to get them back together. Then.
On the World Wide Web. It's circulating on the interwebs. You said that on our last episode. And when I was editing it, I laughed out loud. It was really great on the interwebs. Yeah. Noisetrade.com is a project that Derek started up. And so he's this unbelievably forward-thinking entrepreneur as well. So what a delight to have that guy on the show, man. I mean, what a total dream come true for me. And he totally gets what we're doing here. He understands the whole deconstruction, reconstruction thing. He's going through it himself. And just a good friend. You guys could do a lot worse than to download everything that Derek Webb has ever done.
Oh, my gosh.
I encourage you to do so. And we will have the songs that we played on this episode. Every song you heard on this episode, you can find in the show notes and direction to get to Derek's other material. And
yep.
What are some other things we got to wrap up?
I mean, basically, just enjoy the songs, and if you really like the music, as Adam said, we'll have direction for that in our show notes. And also, you know, the best way that you guys can support us right now as we continue to grow, since we are, as it is hard to believe, still a young podcast in our second month of existence. So continue to send us the feedback, but the way that you can support us the most would be to follow us on our social media. So we are Deconstructionist Podcast on both Facebook and Instagram, Deconstruct Cast on Twitter, and then of course our website is thedeconstructionists.com. But the biggest way beyond that you can support us is just to go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, leave us a nice 5-star review, subscribe to our podcast, and then the biggest way is just continue to tell your friends about us. We have been growing exponentially, purely organically, just through the love of people like you listening. And we thank you so, so much, especially for those who have gone in and donated to help us fund this, because we do pay for this completely out of our pockets. This is not our full-time job. We have full-time jobs and families outside of this. So, Adam, tell them actually how they can donate and help us out with that.
I'm going to actually start. This is a shame. I'm a marketing major, and I didn't think of this beforehand. But we have put in the show notes now the link to the donate button on our website. And here's how this works, guys. We don't have like a Patreon site yet. There's not recurring donations. We don't want to have to even ask for that. I mean, it'd be great. Like, look, if you want a recurring donation, I will make one just for you. You can email me and I'll make you one, and that'd be fantastic. Or you can just cut us an enormous check and just fund this project.
Right.
Or if you know anybody that would like to do that. But listen, right. In all seriousness, if you are finding this to be the kind of place that John and I designed it to be, a safe place where you get to hear different perspectives from different people and grow as a person in your journey of deconstructing and reconstructing, and that's something that you connected with, please help us out. Please help us just pay for some of this equipment, the hosting, the websites, getting these guests on and sounding good, the unbelievable amounts of coffee, LaCroix, and beer that we have to drink.
Yeah.
To keep our sanity, the books, the research, the time, the equipment. John just had to buy a new computer because his crashed and we can't have that happening.
Right.
Microphones, all kinds of other technical aspects of the show. Any support that you can give us financially would be hugely appreciated. And I will even have my wife write you a handwritten thank you note, because honestly, she's probably the one that wants us to get the support more than anyone else. It's like, hey, can my son start taking karate, or are we going to keep doing this podcast?
That's the truth, but we do have some really exciting stuff coming up in the future. But until we can make this more of a full-time thing, we will start getting into every other week, you know, episodes. That was kind of the plan from the beginning before we just kind of got destroyed by all these awesome folks saying yes to us. So we'll continue to do weekly for the next few weeks, and then we're going to kind of get into an every other week.
We're going to let you guys breathe a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Just... Just take a deep breath.
Oh, man. But we do, we are really excited to say that we have the rest of 2016 mapped out. We have
way more than mapped out. Oh, yeah. We're bleeding in 2017.
Yeah.
John, when are we going to get to sleep again?
Never.
I will never sleep again if it means people are going to appreciate these kinds of conversations. Well, we love you guys so much. And we, you know, we really mean that to anybody that's connected with the show, whether you've given us, you know, positive or negative feedback, it really doesn't matter, because if you've been here, then you've been impacted, and we love you.
Yes.
No matter who you are, we are working to grow as people, as producers, as podcasters, as interviewers, and it's a whirlwind, and we're just letting it all hang out there and letting you guys see just in very raw form who we are. Yeah. And so if you've been here, we love you, we thank you, we appreciate you, and we will keep doing this as long as we possibly can.
Yeah, and we hope you hear that the fun that we're having, because this is the most fun thing possibly imagine. So
it really is.
Yeah, thanks for the and thanks everybody for the positive feedback.
We love you guys. Keep deconstructing. For now, we are your hosts. I'm Adam Norlock,
and I'm John Williamson.
Say you always treat people like you like to be. I guess you love being hated for your sexuality. You love when people put words in your mouth about what you believe, make you sound like a freak. Cause if you really believe what you say you believe, you wouldn't be so damn reckless with the words you speak. Wouldn't silently conceal when the liars speak, denying all the dying of the remedy. Tell me, brother, what matters more to you? Tell me, sister, what matters more to you? Tell what's in your heart by what comes out of your mouth. And it sure looks to me like being straight is all it's about. Yeah, it looks like being hated for all the wrong things, like chasing the wind while the pendulum swings. Cause we can talk and debate until we're blue in the face about the language and tradition that he's coming to save. Meanwhile we sit just like we don't give a shit about 50,000 people who are dying today. Tell me, brother, what matters more to you? Tell me, sister, what matters more to you?
This episode sponsored by Marathon Sports. Running shoes online can feel like a guessing game, but Marathon Sports makes it easy to get the right gear without stepping into a store. At MarathonSports.com, you'll find the same trusted brands runners and walkers rely on, including Brooks, Hoka, New Balance, Asics, Saucony, and more. Whether you're training for a race, walking for fitness, or just need everyday comfort, Marathon Sports has the shoes, apparel, and accessories to keep you moving. Their online shop is built for athletes and everyday movers. Easy browsing, detailed product guidance, and fast shipping help you find exactly what you need without the hassle. Because the right gear doesn't just improve your run, it improves how you feel every day. Shop now at MarathonSports.com and get moving.